Welcome back to the Film Feeder podcast. I'm your film chef extraordinaire, Jack Martin, here to serve up plenty of tasty commentary from within the world of film. And I'm delighted to be joined once more by actor, producer, and founder of Noble Gas Media, Max Wertendyke. How are you doing today, Max?
I'm doing great, Jack. Thanks for having me again. I'm excited to be here and excited to talk about the conversation.
Yes, that's right, folks. Today is all about Francis Ford Coppola's 1974 movie, The Conversation, which is, of course, celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And this episode, we will be discussing our initial thoughts on the film, its various relevant themes, its historical significance, and ultimately why it is a film that you should be seeking out. And I think that it's worth mentioning as well that here in the UK, at least, the film is actually getting a big screen re-release. The good people over at Studio Canal are re-releasing it with an all-new 4K restoration of the film, and that will be in cinemas over here anyway from the 5th of July. And then later on in the month, they'll be releasing a special collector's edition featuring both Blu-ray and 4K Ultra HD copies of the film. It includes dozens of special features, a 64-page booklet with new essays, copy of the film's poster, and I think this is the most exciting part, a cassette tape copy of the film's soundtrack. So that's something for hardcore fans of this movie to purchase when that hits shelves over here on the 15th of July. So let's get right into it, and we'll start with you, Max, because this movie means a fair bit to you already, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. You know, I mean, so much of the work that I do as a producer and as when we're developing films are films in a sort of thriller genre. And so when I think about, you know, the films that sort of deal with that in, I think, a fascinating way, The Conversation is one that I always look to. And in fact, is a film that I've many times watched prior to filming or prior to sort of getting into some creative meetings with people I'm working with on thrillers in particular. I just think there are so many fascinating sequences and elements throughout the film. I think, you know, you could argue that it sort of has a very clear, actually, like three-act structure. Each of those acts, you know, sort of has these different sequences in which the way information is doled out to the audience, I find incredibly intriguing. And I find that as a viewer of the film, my imagination and my curiosity is really strung along in a fantastic way, both from a sort of, you know, the mystery thriller part of the story and also just the character driven parts of the story as well. And I've seen this film, you know, a bunch of times and watched again, obviously, in preparation for this. And every time I think I sort of see a little bit more or revealed to me in an exciting way.
Yeah, and for me, this was actually quite a unique experience for me because this was a film that, until this episode, I actually had never seen. I mean, I'd seen clips of it before. You know, people had shown me, like, the opening scene or whatever, but I never saw the actual film as a whole. And I actually went out and bought the DVD, you know, support physical media and all that. But I watched it, and, you know, I was very impressed by it. I felt that it was a very tightly paced film. It's got a lot of really interesting twists and turns, and I think for me the real standout of it is just the way that it's filmed. It's quite a compelling mystery in and of itself, but I think a lot of that is amplified by the way that Francis Ford Coppola really kind of fine-tunes the film, and we'll be talking about how that is possible with all the cinematography and the editing, especially the sound design as well. And I think that it really grips you. I think it really leaves you on the kind of edge of your seat. I know, to use that old cliche, but it's a very special film, and I think it's quite fascinating, you know, because when Francis Ford Coppola made this, it was in between the first two Godfather movies, and it's like,
I mean, this, when you look at his filmography and you realize when this film got made, and that entire decade for him, obviously, like an incredibly fruitful decade between the Godfather's, Apocalypse Now, but you know, to think that this was his sort of you know, in between these big studio tent poles of the Godfather, you know, no one I think knew just how well the Godfather would do, but you know, in between those big studio movies, you know, this desire to sort of make this smaller, contained, you know, for him, more independent. So this is a film that he must have felt, and I don't know anything, you know, I don't know him, but he must have felt compelled to make in an extreme kind of way that, you know, just given everything else that was going on, I think it's safe to assume that his plate was pretty full. And you know, so his compulsion to make this film must have been strong, which is, of course, also interesting just thinking about Megalopolis now and, you know, thinking about sort of this last film of him, is that he clearly has also been compelled to make despite anyone else's protestations or reservations. You know, I sort of said, no, I want to make the movie that I want to make of this movie. And this seems to, I think, fit into at least the arc of that.
Yeah, Francis Ford Coppola really strikes me as a filmmaker who is very fierce about his vision. Like, you get a lot of filmmakers
Jackie
who are,
there.
you know, obviously very protective of how they perceive film and that. But Francis Ford Coppola, you know, reading all the stories over the years, just all these insane things. Like, I mean, all the stuff that happened on Apocalypse Now is just it's literally its own film. But especially with the conversation in terms of his own vision, it's a compelling vision. It's one that you don't really see a lot of nowadays. It's a very it feels very epic without feeling epic, you know, like it's in a different way to something like The Godfather or Apocalypse Now or even Megalopolis, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm very
Me neither.
curious to see how
I'm gonna go see it in IMAX. I don't care what the reviews say. I'm gonna do it because I want to know.
I kind of want to know too.
Yeah.
But so with the conversation, I think again, a lot of people watching this might not necessarily have seen the film and might want to know a little bit of what it's about. So you're probably the better person to ask. So, I mean, do you think you can give like a bit of a summary as to
All
what the
right,
film
yeah,
is?
let's see if I can do that without giving too much away. The premise of the film essentially is Gene Hackman is Harry Cole, and he's considered, you know, top of his career audio surveillance man. As one of the other one of another character in the film calls him, you know, he's the best bugger in the West, meaning that, you know, his ability to tap phones or to be able to sort of get information
I have to say, in the
is
UK, that means something, but the best bugger in the system means something very different over here.
In for the record, I think it is also is implied. You know, I mean, we'll get there, but there's a relationship with, particularly in the second act, with a sort of rival audio surveillance man, and there's definitely a tension between the two. So either way, so he's this man is really at the top of his game, and he's been hired to record a couple. Or a seeming young couple who's walking around San Francisco's Union Square. And this is the opening sequence of the film. It's an awesome sequence for a whole slew of reasons, which we may get into a little later. But you open up the film and you're just seeing this sort of wide open shot of this couple talking. You're picking up bits and pieces of conversation. And what you find out is that he's been hired to record this conversation and then deliver it to a mysterious director. You know, it's not clear who that is or what their intentions are. And as he sort of begins to do his work of fine-tuning the recordings to make the tapes comprehensible to his client, who's the director, he begins to hear things on the tape that make him feel that the people he's recorded lives may be in danger. And you do find out at some point in the film, and I don't think this is so much of a spoiler alert, that in the past, and one of the reasons that he left the East Coast was because previously some work that he had done had resulted in harm to the people that he had recorded. And Harry Cole's character is a sort of a fairly devout Catholic. And so, you know, his, I think, guilt in regards to what his work, what it wrought upon the world, feels pretty deep. And he refuses to turn over the tapes, which sort of gets him wrapped up in this mystery as he is trying to figure out what exactly is going to happen, what his responsibility is from an ethical standpoint, or not, and what to do about it. I would say, without getting into more specific details that sort of reveal some of the twists and turns, I would say that is a kind of general overview of the plot.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty comprehensive way of putting it. It's a very, I mean, w again, without giving anything away, there are places that it goes which are in and of themselves quite disturbing, and it's very, very shocking. One of the things I was picking up on watching this, it feels like a version of Rear Window if it took place in more than one room, because there are similarities. I mean, the guy is looking into people's lives and eventually comes across something that isn't very nice, and is him just trying to put the pieces together. And there's a very
It certainly
interesting.
has a Hitchcockian feel to it in some degree. I think that feels like an apt comparison.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, because there's obviously so much there's a lot about this that feels very Hitchcockian. Like that's just the way that it's filmed. I mean, like the opening scene in and of itself is quite tense, even though nothing tense is necessarily happening. It's literally just these people trying to record the conversation of the title, but it's, you know, just they're trying to do it in a very discreet way, and sometimes, you know, things get in the way, like just a mime will just show up and just kind of, you know, mess with them, and then, you
One
know,
of the things
just.
that's so cool about that opening sequence is that as a viewer, it really takes you a while to orient, to even figure out what it is that you're supposed to be viewing. And it sort of does this amazing thing where, you're seeing this big high shot of all of Union Square, and you're seeing tons of people moving around it, and you're actually not clear as to what you're supposed to be paying attention to and or watching. And as the camera sort of slowly zooms in, and as the what you're hearing, sort of this distorted conversation, you're hearing parts of, you're not hearing other parts of, it's a kind of clarity. It kind of zooms into this way until the end of that sequence. Some of the shots are incredibly intimate and like incredibly close, and you feel like very almost voyeuristic, but it's this strange voyeurism that starts from so far away. And you slowly find your way to the source of what's happening. And for me, it's just always been like when I talk about the reveal of information, that's like the perfect example of it. I spend the first couple moments of that film, minutes even, saying, okay, who am I supposed to be watching? Oh, it's a movie about a mime. Because as you mentioned, Jackie, there's this mime that's sort of like doing this great act, and it's this amazing, funny act. And you're sort of sitting there thinking, like, well, mimes don't talk, but so what the hell am I listening to? And as you get down, it sort of has this feeling of being an outsider who then gets extremely close to the people that you're watching. And obviously, Harry Call, I think, this is both a visual metaphor for who he is. This is a man who's kind of incapable of having any real conversation with anyone in his life. And yet his life becomes obsessively surrounding this conversation that he records between two people who do end up turning out to be lovers. And so, he's spending all his time sort of being obsessed with this conversation between lovers, but it's absolutely incapable of doing the same in his own life. And I think this is just such a fascinating way that Coppola and his team like create a visual metaphor for a character arc and, sort of just interweave all these different elements at play.
Yeah, exactly. Because Harry Call, as we see in the film, is incredibly private about his life. Like he, there's a scene early on where he just like comes back to his apartment and he finds someone had gotten in and just left a little gift there or something for his
Just for his
birthday.
birthday, yeah.
And one of his first instincts is to call the super and just kind of tell him, you know, actually, I don't want any more unexpected visitors or anything like that. I want the locks changed or what the keys changed or whatever. He's just so fiercely guarding of his own private life. And yeah, the irony is, of course, that he is kind of doing the exact opposite to other people. You know, it feels like a slight hypocrisy on his part. But that, I think that's one of the things that makes the character so fascinating to watch. So, you know, seeing this incredibly private man, like he's borderline recluse. He lives alone in an apartment and just it doesn't really have much of a social life. Just really, like you say, becoming obsessed with a recording of people who he doesn't know. He doesn't really have a conversation with either of them throughout the film, but he's just so deeply embedded into what they're saying that it's just like maybe it's his way of trying to connect with the world and in a sense kind of make up for his past mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, I think in that scene you reference where he calls his landlord, I believe he says something like, because the landlord, you don't hear it, but is presumed is saying, well, we need an extra key in case there's a fire or, if there's something dangerous. And he basically says, I'd rather have all of my effects burn up than have someone have access to my apartment. And when you get to the final image of the film, which ultimately he's sort of in a paranoid rampage, I guess, sort of disassembles his apartment, in a way that almost feels surreal rather than literal, at the end of the film. But the final image of the film is him sitting in his apartment entirely destroyed. The walls have been taken down, the floors have been ripped up, all the lights have, the sockets have been inspected to make sure that there isn't, any kind of recording devices there. And he holds that promise at the end of the film. And literally, like, he would rather destroy everything around him, really, than be visible to those around him in some ways.
And I think one of the interesting things about that final shot, I mean, no, we're jumping all over the place here, but like one of the interesting things I always found it, the way that it just kind of moves around, it just goes from one area of the apartment to the next. And in the while, he's in the foreground, just kind of like playing his saxophone because, yeah, that's the only thing that he kind of enjoys in his life, just playing that sax. And what I liked about that is just like the way that the camera moves, it's almost kind of like you're watching CCTV footage. Like there's a camera just kind of like going from one end to the other, kind of like how, you know, you usually see cameras do. And I think that kind of ties into and summarizes the overarching theme of surveillance quite perfectly, honestly, because there's so much about this film that's just it feels prophetic in a way about the nature of being surveilled and not having any much of a right to privacy in a modern technological age. And I think this film kind of really taps into the paranoia that, you know, maybe, you know, this is an Orwellian future after all. Maybe there is someone like watching us, like you said, in the walls to where we're just kind of pulling everything out and just kind of making sure that there's nothing there. So it's kind of fascinating how Coppola really kind of brings all those themes together in such breft visual language.
The irony to me, of course, you know, in the comparisons to modern day is that, you know, the characters of the conversation don't desire to be recorded, don't desire to be spied on. And I think the irony today, of course, is that we do most of our own surveillance ourselves. You know, we record ourselves in the privacy of our homes and we post it online. You know, we record our like everyday thoughts and post them online to, you know, like mass public. And so I do think there is sort of a distinct and interesting difference just culturally when we think about, you know, the way surveillance takes place, that in the conversation, it's really everyone is unknowing. Harry himself at one point gets recorded in the second act by this other, you know, rival audio surveillance man, a man named Bernie, played by Alan Garfield, who's like so wonderfully sleazy and like, I mean, such what a wonderful character part, what a great little appearance in this film. And you know, obviously when he's recorded, he feels so violated. And I think all the characters sort of feel that violation in the film. And the irony is, of course, is that we do most of the recording ourselves these days and make it public. I mean, this right now, obviously we're talking about a film. It's not our private lives, but you know, still.
Yeah, it's still like windows into, you know, our own personal lives. I mean, obviously, where you are right now, you know, that people are technically seeing this on the recording, at least in the video version. I don't know for those listening right now, but on video, yeah, it's definitely a window into our lives. And I think it's all about, you know, just that sense of voyeurism as well. Like, but what is that people get so caught up in wanting to know more about other people's lives? You know, I mean, that explains most of reality TV nowadays. But I think there's a kind of perverseness in just becoming obsessed like Harry is in this film with wanting to know what's in these people's minds, what they're thinking about. And it kind of develops this unhealthy parasocial relationship with people who at first seem like they're just kind of like going about, you know, their day. They're wandering through the park, they're commenting on the homeless guy on the bench. And, you know, just it's a very fairly normal conversation until he discovers some of the content in said conversation. But I feel that Harry, in and of itself, if he existed today, he'd be living in his mum's basement without having lived anywhere else. You know, he just seems like a very antisocial kind of guy. And it's through these people, these two people, that he kind of develops a kind of fascination with a strange, not romantic in any sense, but just kind of like, why am I so invested in this? Why am I so caught up in these people's life, even though, again, I don't know them personally. And yeah, that sort of thing. I don't know. I feel like I'm jumping around all over the place. I'm just
No,
like.
well, I mean, you know, thinking about like the romantic relationships in the film, I mean, there are two sort of very distinct moments where we see Harry Call interact with these two very different women. You know, one being Terry Garr, who plays Amy, who seems to sort of been his like sometime girlfriend, who he goes to visit, and she asks him some questions. and he doesn't want to respond, and he flees. And you know, it's this amazing thing that the film does, where it really drops him into these momentary relationships with other people. You know, as much as the film is a mystery, thriller mystery, it is about the sort of exploration of, I think, this one man's psyche. And so we get to see these little elements. So when he shows up, you know, at this little apartment, and Amy's sort of already in bed, and she describes how she always thinks that the way he enters the apartment, he's trying to catch her doing something that he doesn't know. In fact, she reveals this great moment where she has seen him observing her and that he doesn't know. You know, so it's like, in a way, she has caught him watching her. And I think it begins this interesting conversation where she tries to find out some things about him. And it's not that he doesn't want to reveal himself, I don't think. I think that he feels incapable. And I think that bears fruit, you know, in this second act. Just to be clear, so the first act, as the way I'm describing it, is sort of the capturing of this conversation of the title in Union Square, and sort of the immediate aftermath of that, him and his partner, you know, working to try and actually figure out what's been being said. The second act takes place at a sort of convention. It's, you know, a wiretappers convention. It's every wiretapper and audio surveillance person from, you know, around the country has come to this one convention. And the second act sort of takes place through that convention and a strange, very strange sort of aria of a scene, a little party that takes place in Harry Call's working space. In that scene, there's a woman played by, I think it's Elizabeth McRae, who plays Meredith. And it's unclear if she's a hired sex worker or if she's just sort of there for a good time. But she and Harry seem to have this kind of intimate moment together. She seems interested in him, and he shares some of his feelings about Amy, the character. And he sort of talks about, like, you know, why can't I share anything with her? I sort of seem incapable, even though I might be in love with her. I mean, he uses these words like love. And, you know, for me, sitting in 2024, the idea of loving a person that you don't know and who doesn't know anything about you sort of seems hard to conceive of. But he sort of makes this great emotional confession, which is what Bernie, his rival, does actually end up recording and sort of quite embarrasses him in this party. You know, I just think so his relationship with these, you know, these two scenes with these two different women in his life, one of whom is sort of waiting for him to show up and one of whom is sort of pursuing him, he's able to reveal himself more intimately to the latter rather than the first. And I just think that says something about how scared he is to get close to people, actually. The film doesn't suggest why exactly that's the case.
I think it maybe ties into, like you say, because he has gone through a very difficult past thing. You know, one of the more recent ones that he's been not required to do is just like, you know, people ended up getting hurt and even killed, and I think he expresses a lot of guilt about his actions in that. He has a lot of Catholic guilt as well, because there is a scene of him going to confession in church, and his faith even ties into that final scene later on. But it seems like, you know, Harry is so consumed with, you know, the fact that he did let these people down, that he's just kind of very determined to make sure that, you know, not only does it not happen again, but also that people come out of it, you know, not even being harmed. You know, he just wants people to be safe, but it seems to be at the expense of his own social life. He deliberately isolates himself to protect the world in some kind of ill-advised noble sense. But I think it's very interesting how it's portrayed, because I mean, on the one hand, you think, like, you see a guy like Harry and he's very withdrawn, very, he just kind of keeps to himself. You know, even when he's being pestered by you know, co-workers, he just kind of snaps at them, just like, oh, nothing, leave me alone. One of the things I really like about it is it's a very interesting character piece. Like, it's a very deep study of this person who, by all accounts, you know, wouldn't be a necessarily exciting person to watch for like an hour and a half or 2 hours. But it's made interesting because the writing really kind of makes these characters feel human and makes them very three-dimensional. And especially the acting as well. I think Gene Hackman is just a great actor anyway. He always has been. And this is after, you know, he came onto the scene in films like The French Connection and all those. But this is a very different role. In fact, I did some research. Apparently, he found it very difficult to get into character for this because apparently it was very unlike him in real life. So I think it's a very interesting case to be made there about losing yourself in a character who is so far removed from who you are in real life.
One of the things that I think is cool about the part is, I mean, Harry Cole is an unattractive character. Like, there's very little that's like beautiful or cool or hot about him. And I think one of the things that Gene Hackman does so well sort of plays that character so fully, you know, that there seems to be no vanity in the part. And as an audience member, like, I always really love watching that in actors. And I'll say, I think that is true for every character in the film. And so you have to credit the writing and the directing to bring it up. Bernie, who's this rival audience surveillance guy, is so desperate and feels so insecure. He spends his entire scene talking about how great he is and, you know, how he's been able to do this and do that and do this and do that. And, you know, he was able to bug these guys and do, you know, the record this phone conversation. And yet it is so clearly a desperate attempt to get Harry's approval. That's why he records him in that scene, is to prove that he can, you know, record the best recordist. He gives a little reveal as he talks about the first phone he ever tapped was in the halls of his tenement building in New York. And you just get this glimpse, you know, he's a short man. Alan Garfield is this short, you know, sort of like, you know, he kind of like scrappy kind of guy. Also not a beautiful man, you know, it's like, and in any kind of like sort of statuesque kind of way. And you just get this sense that this is a guy who has spent his whole life being told that he's not good enough. And, you know, God damn it, he's going to prove otherwise. But the sort of clarity with which these characters reveal themselves, you know, Terry Garr's last line of Amy is, you know, she says to him, I don't think I'm going to wait for you anymore. The characters speak in a kind of honesty and truth. And in some ways, they're all very exposed. It's really sort of a remarkable thing. And as an audience member, and perhaps as someone with an acting background, like, you know, I find it quite moving, actually. And I think, like, just the sort of the unguardedness of the characters and of the acting that goes underneath it feels like such a strong element to the film to me.
Yeah, and I think so much of that does come from these performances. I mean, the scene you were mentioning, that the party scene, it's like it could be its own stage play, you know, like it genuinely could. Like I'm genuinely curious if Coppola actually did write it for the stage before adapting it into a script, because it's such a deftly played sequence, you know, because it plays around with the location and certain camera shots, and it's quite a remarkably played piece of filmmaking because it conveys so much, but it's not like showy about it, and it's very ingenious how it does it. And I think a lot of it really does come down to the performances. Like, I mean, because obviously you've got Gene Hackman in there, you've got John Cazale, I hope I'm pronouncing that name right, and all these other people, and even people I didn't even expect to show up here. Harrison Ford is in this movie, and Robert Duvall is uncredited in the movie. He's the guy
The
who,
unnamed director, you
the
know,
unnamed
yeah.
director, yeah, and he just shows up for a couple of scenes, and that's it. All of these people, like, even no matter how short that on screen they are, like, you do want to know more about them. You don't want to know what is kind of like what they're going through. You kind of, in a sense, like Harry, wanting to dive into these people's lives a lot more than they're giving you. And it's really well played, I think.
I would agree wholeheartedly. I don't know if it's worth, you know, thinking about that party scene always reminds me a little bit of like the first 20 minutes of Faces, the Cassavetes film. There's a sort of like drunken cinema veritas feel of it, where you really sort of feel almost like you're at the party and you're not really sure what's going to happen and you're not really sure where to look next or who's going to talk. It feels very free form in that way. And for a film that is otherwise so controlled, you know, and for a character, Harry Cole, that is generally so controlled, it's sort of this really, I think, fascinating to see him in a relationship with all these other people. And like when it goes well for him and when it doesn't go well for him is both sort of like hilarious and heartbreaking and alarming, and strange.
Yeah, it's quite powerful, and that's, you know, it's really the one time in the film that you really do see him properly interact with people. And there are moments where he genuinely feels at ease, like he's genuinely let his guard down, you know, he's opening himself up to all these people, and then they just kind of throw it back in his face. And it's quite cruel, but it's also, you know, quite indicative of the character himself. Like you can tell that this is a man who desperately wants to connect with the world, but he is so consumed by the actions of his past that he just won't allow himself to do that. And because of that, he has kind of become like a bit of a shell of himself. Like he's really just kind of so isolated to the point where, who he maybe once was maybe doesn't exist anymore. There are fragments, but by and large, the Harry Caul that everyone regards as the best bugger in the West, or the East, I can't remember. Either way, the best bugger. Say sounds so weird say, in the UK sense, but you know what I mean. Like he's the best bugger in the East, but he's he's just not that person anymore, and it's quite tragic when you think about it because this is a guy who, by all accounts, should be more outgoing than he is.
I think that's like a fascinating point, actually, that we haven't talked about. And it's not something that I think gets brought up in a lot of the reviews, which is that part of what Harry's character is that like he is his fall from grace, is that he's gotten worse at the job. Very early on, Stan, who's his coworker, he accuses, he says, you shouldn't be listening to conversations. You should just be thinking about the recording. The recording would be better. You don't pay attention to what they're saying. That's not our job. Our job is just to deliver the tapes. What happens thereafter has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with us. We're not to engage, And over the course of the film, you sort of see him make a series of mistakes. Harry too has gotten sloppy. And I think like part of the reason he's gotten sloppy is because he can no longer afford to feel objective about the things he's listening to. He is no longer like us as an audience member, an objective, external voyeuristic force. He keeps seeing himself in the stories that he's recording. He feels his faith is involved. I mean, what a thing to feel like, to feel like what you're doing is so tied up with your faith, which is like part of his deep identity. He tells Stan early on, don't take the Lord's name in vain. It's a great moment because up until this point, we have no idea that he's been religious at all. In fact, we wouldn't assume he is. He's listening, eavesdropping on these people's conversations. He seems like free to, otherwise, like, talk freely with his coworkers in a sort of gruff manner. But so when this moment happens, you think, oh, this is a character who has a deep Catholic faith, who does believe in a God, and it seems that who he is and what the ideal of his faith are no longer quite matched up. And I think, so much of the film is about this man who reached a pinnacle in his career and also like is no longer as good at it as he used to be, and therefore his identity is eroding even further.
You could say this is almost his come to Jesus moment. So,
Yeah, literally.
I think those are all really good points, but I think we do have to address a real star of the film, and it's quite an unexpected one. It really is the sound design. We should mention the sound design was done by a guy named Walter Murch. He's quite a known editor. He's worked on everything from the Godfather films to Apocalypse Now. I think he won an Oscar for The English Patient. He's also worked on some of the earlier George Lucas films, American Graffiti and THX 1138. And he creates the sound in this. And sound is a real secret weapon of the film. One of the very first things is like you hear just all the scramblings of the recordings or the audio recordings, and it's put to quite eerie use in the film. And it feels otherworldly at times. Like when you're watching people speak, the stuff that comes out of mouth, it's just like all garbled and fuzzed and stuff. And it feels very odd until it's like adjusted, until it's then, some sort of speech is much clearer. And the sound is quite stunning in that regard. It really kind of makes you feel a bit more creeped out by because you just don't know what's going on until it's all filled around with.
When you mentioned earlier that, you're getting a theatrical re-release in the UK, I just thought, what an amazing way to watch this film is in a theater, if there's a 5.1 surround sound mix, like really getting to feel enveloped by the sound would be genuinely an experience worth having, I think, because the sound design. And I also want to mention David Shire, who, did the music for the film as well too. There's like an amazing sort of like little piano theme that plays throughout that I can connect very much with the film. And I think just being in that aural universe of the film would be such a wonderful treat because it really is its own character. And in fact, a large point in the plot, a big turning point in the plot, has to do with the way one listens to the sounds in the film. And just how rarely do you get to see something in a visual medium like film where sound truly plays such an important part, both I think conceptually and actually plot-wise.
Yeah, I think perhaps the most recent example I can think of where sound has played such a vital role in the overall execution of the film and all that, getting it all its points across so effectively, is The Zone of Interest, which is a film that relies heavily on sound that is just always in the background. Like even in scenes that are very mundane, you're always hearing this mechanical hum, and it's so chilling, because when you know the context of that film, and when you know what's going on, the normal stuff you never see, like it is genuinely frightening. And so much of that does come from the sound. And that film recently won the Oscar, and it very well deserved, I think, because again, like you said, it's rare to think of a sound designer that has played such a vital role in the overall tone and execution of a film. I mean, sound is such an important factor in film in and of itself. That so many of our favorite films have relied on sound, all the stuff that goes on in the DeLorean and Back to the Future, or all the effects in Star Wars, or even in my case as a Brit, all the TARDIS sounds on Doctor Who. But point is, sound has a way of really amplifying a viewing experience. And in the case of The Conversation, and a little bit of The Zone of Interest as well, it really helps the storytelling, because like you said, so much of the plot hinges on what a character may or may not hear in a certain recording. And the way that it just kind of unfolds, it's a real like M. Night Shyamalan before M. Night Shyamalan kind of twist. Like all the pieces come together and it's like, oh my God, that's what happened. Like it's really, really quite ingenious how this guy, again, his name is Walter Murch, he really just kind of gets the heart of it and really makes the film even better.
Yeah, I mean, hands down, it's like a film. The visual language of the film is incredibly strong, but it's really filled in by the aural soundscape of the film as well, which is appropriate.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a film called The Conversation. It wouldn't work as a silent film
That's
exactly.
right. I will say there are parts of the film that are quite silent, and I think like that too is part of it also, that like the parts that have sound, there's some parts that are quite loud, or the saxophone playing that you mentioned earlier too, it's like a very brassy forward facing sound. It's hard to mistake, and the film, the silence in the film bumps up against the sound in the film, I think also helps create this very exciting sort of rhythm.
And I think we also have to mention as well the cinematography in the film. So it's an interesting case. So officially credited is Bill Butler for the cinematography. So he did Jaws and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and even Rockies 2 to 4. But originally the cinematographer was Haskell Wexler, who was originally brought on, but I think he had a bunch of creative disagreements with Francis Ford Coppola and he was subsequently fired. But that was shortly after production began, and Haskell Wexler had originally shot much of that opening sequence, especially that crane shot that opens the film, and that is all Haskell Wexler. So technically some of his work is in the film, but every other bit of it was reshot, other than that massively ambitious crane shot. That's all Bill Butler. The 99% of the film is Bill Butler, but that opening shot is pretty much Haskell Wexler. The cinematography, like you said, it's quite astounding. Like there's a shot that really stands out to me. It takes place during the party scene, and because it takes place in like this little abandoned warehouse area, and it's just a wide shot and it's just empty aside from just Harry just standing there, and it's just so small in his surroundings. And it's quite a powerful shot, because again, talking about visual storytelling, it just shows how small he feels in this world, how small he really has made his own world, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, absolutely. There's another one that always comes to mind is, in that first sequence you talked about earlier, when he first shows up back at his apartment and discovers this birthday gift and is calling his landlord to sort of complain about that. This amazing thing happens. The camera is locked off, and Harry's sitting on what looks like kind of like a telephone table, and he's having the call. And then he gets up and moves, and the camera stays on the empty space. And then it pans to lock back off. He's now sitting on the couch. And the scene continues there for a while. And he gets up out of frame again and then walks back into frame. And it makes me think about what you're saying earlier about the sort of the CCTV surveillance footage. But it's this very interesting thing also, where like the camera does not follow Harry. That Harry walks in and out of the frame and disappears from view and reappears from view as well. It's like almost as if, in some cases, the camera is not any more focused on Harry as a unique individual as Harry is focused on ostensibly on these unique individuals he's recording. There's sort of an objective, again, voyeuristic point of view from the camera, I think, that comes throughout. Then, with some of these few exceptions, there's this weird, I'm curious what you think about, there's this very weird sort of surrealistic dream sequence. Which is like, it's like a weird dream ballet in the middle of this thriller that I had kind of forgotten about actually until I rewatched. And I just thought, what a strange, it's like moody and there's smoke and he's like calling to one of the characters in
It's like, did Dario Argento take over for a day? It's just like, what is happening? It's just, I have to say, like, I never thought I'd see a weird, like, surreal dream sequence in a film that is this grounded in reality. Like, it's a bit off-putting at first. Like, I know the dream sequencer can be used to, like, express a person's thoughts or whatever, but it's just something you don't expect to see in this kind of film. Like, it's,
It's strange. I mean, it feels very 70s to me,
oh,
but
yeah.
it is very strange. But it's just, I guess the as it relates to the cinematography is just, thinking about sort of all the different ways the camera is used very purposely, and the camera moves are very purposeful, and the framing is obviously very purposeful, which of course you expect from a master director, and master cinematographers. But it's just all these different methods of sort of communicating where Harry's psyche is, I think.
Yeah, it's a strange sequence. I mean, obviously it's strange because it's obviously a fragment of someone's imagination, but obviously it conveys just the kind of like the guilt he has, and obviously wanting to make sure that the person he's been surveilling is going to be okay, and it's all that stuff. But it's a very, again, it kind of it feels like the kind of invasion into his own head that he is actively trying to discourage when he's conscious. Like, in a way, it's the film kind of like showing in its own kind of like artsy way just exactly what literally what's going on inside his mind. Like, it's probably the deepest we ever get to his actual psyche without him ever revealing too much about himself. And it really definitely worked with a lot of people, because obviously when the film debuted in 74, like, it was quite critically acclaimed. I mean, again, Coppola was coming off of The Godfather at the time. I mean, he made this, again, like we said, he made this in between the first two Godfathers.
The only two that really count. I mean, let's be honest about it.
So he made it in between those two, and I think all the attention that Coppola got from The Godfather, obviously, people were curious. It's like, oh wow, it's this new film from this same director, then it's very different, but it still worked. The film, it got a huge amount of acclaim at the time of its release. It got nominated for three Oscars. It was Best Picture, Original Screenplay, and Sound, all of which honestly makes sense for this kind of film. And it even won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Francis Ford Coppola, I believe, is one of a few directors who holds the distinction of winning two Palme d'Ors. He also won it for Apocalypse Now, I believe. So it's definitely had its fair share of critical acclaim and obviously awards season buzz, but at the time it was considered a box office disappointment, even though it wasn't technically a bomb. It did make a $4 million worldwide on a budget of like $1.5 million, so it technically made a profit, which is weird to me that it's considered like a financial flop, because technically it's not.
I
I
mean, I
mean,
guess the two questions, and the one thing that we don't know is, like what the P&A spend was on it. So, I mean, I guess like that will obviously a film that's really only doing like, 3x or 2x, like a big P&A spend could bite into that a lot. I also think it's just that in comparison to The Godfather, in comparison to sort of the rest of his work from that decade, it just feels like quite modest. In comparison, The Godfather in 1972 made somewhere between $250 and $291 million.
My God.
So, of course, it costs quite a bit more to make, but you're hitting almost $300 million, a film that's going to make $4 million here. This is an American Zoetrope film too, so it's like sort of in the indie. It's an indie. This is it's a Coppola indie, and I think that just maybe just in light of the sort of financial success of the films that surround it, it just feels like a dud. Although obviously, like I think it's has a strong cultural importance,
Yeah, and I
and it
think,
did fine.
it did perfectly fine. It wasn't a massive blockbuster, but it did okay.
I mean, we're still talking about it 50 years later, so.
Absolutely,
I had to pay $3 to rent it from Apple TV, so it's still making money.
Yeah, not bad. I spent like about £7 on the DVD, so it's not too bad either. So
There you go.
yeah. And but I think I think we also have to take into consideration, the fact that it got so much attention at the time, even though it didn't amount to box office. I mean, because entirely by accident, it was released months just before the Watergate scandal kind of reached its culmination. And, all the stories are going on about like wiretapping and surveillance and stuff that are kind of obviously plays into the themes of the conversation a bit too closely for some people at the time. So it's just thinking like a lot of people thought, oh, maybe this is like Coppola's answer to Watergate. And it's just like, not necessarily. It just happened to be that at the time. In fact, a lot of the instruments they use in the film, apparently they were developed by experts in the field that didn't necessarily exist, but then they found out they actually used very similar items during that whole recording scandal that Nixon got himself involved in.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously the timeline that it makes to make a film, you can't make a film a couple months prior to something. I mean,
No.
it doesn't work at that speed. So,
No, it
this
doesn't.
is obviously it was something that had been on Coppola's mind for some time. And I think probably was just like in some ways in the culture's mind in general. This is like this different idea of what back to what you said originally, this different idea for the American public in particular about what privacy meant, what it meant to be recorded, what it meant to be in private versus being public, and just, what kind of access people could have to that part of yourselves.
Yeah, I think one of the most shocking things for the people at the time with the whole Watergate thing was just, the fact that, people in incredibly powerful positions could authorize the just kind of invading people's lives in that sense. And I think it was just such a big scandal at the time. I mean, it's fascinating to read about, but it's just it had to feel like Nixon's kind of like a real life Harry Caul in a sense, because he's probably fiercely private in real life, but at the same time he's authorizing people to just kind of like do all these things in order to gain the upper hand politically. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure Harry Caul's a lot more charismatic than Nixon was, but like it's just I don't know,
I mean,
the real life parallels are just
some
kind
people
of.
like Nixon enough to vote for him. So, I mean, he
Yeah.
was appealing to somebody.
At the time,
One
sure,
of
yeah, maybe.
the funny lines that takes, one of the sort of running themes that takes place at this convention is whether the surveillance people are public or private, and meaning whether they work for law enforcement or the government, or whether they are sort of, private hires. And it's this interesting split that is not delved into deeply in the film, but certainly helps create some like context around it, that there seems, at this convention of all these wiretappers in the world, there are two kinds essentially: the ones who can be hired by private corporations like Harry Caul and like Bernie. The Bernie's big claim to fame is that I'm going to screw up the names, but he called Corvette and said Corvette whoever that Ford was going to get rid of the fins on their car. And it's like this is the big corporate espionage that he's participated in. So there's those private investigators like that, and then there are in fact the operators of government and of the police force that sort of employ these tactics. And of course, we don't see those people's stories, but they are also in the world. And I think it just creates an interesting political context around the film.
Yeah, and I think you also have to consider, the role that that government surveillance plays in our modern society. I mean, all the stuff that Edward Snowden got infamous for, exposing all of that. It's not a very well-kept secret, that there is some kind of surveillance going on. In terms of like, oh, maybe this person might be committing a felony. We should keep an eye on him and stuff. But I think it's more like just the people's kind of like right to privacy that most people feel is being violated. And I mentioned earlier that this film is quite prophetic in the sense that, it is suggesting, that there are ways that powerful forces can tap into the private lives of people. And it is very 1984 George Orwell kind of stuff going on, but it's happening in such a contemporary society that nowadays it's just even more shocking because, like you said, we are so ingrained in technology with our phones and obviously on Zoom right now. And there's always a little fear in the back of your head, just thinking like, oh wait, is someone at their desk in the NSA just like watching me right now as I like talk with you about this film. It's just like
I mean,
that.
I hope they're committed to watching more interesting and more pressing. I mean, listen, this is a very interesting and important conversation, but I hope the NSA has bigger things to think about. I think also like One of the things that's interesting about the way the film works is that access to information doesn't mean accurate interpretation of said information either. You know, and I think like that's also part of it, is that just because we can hear something we're not supposed to hear or see something we're not supposed to see, doesn't actually mean that we know what it means or that we can contextualize it in the right way. And you know, so I think there's that half of it. And then for us in this modern day, you know, I mean, we're just all suckers for convenience. I mean, it's just too convenient. Like, none of us really want to go through the hassle of not being able to like look something up instantaneously. I wanted to know how, you know, how much The Godfather made, so I just did it. The cost is that my phone now knows that I wanted to know what The Godfather made, and that's not, doesn't seem like valuable information. It's not to you and I particularly, but you know, at an aggregate scale, you know, data, big data is in fact a business model. And but all of us, you know, at the end of the day, we don't like our privacy being invaded, but we hate actually having to take time to get the things we want more instead. What's more important, that I get toilet paper tomorrow from Amazon, or that Amazon doesn't know my buying habits? And 90% of us, for better or for worse, would rather get our toilet paper tomorrow.
This is very true, especially during the pandemic. And in a sense, you know, we're all kind of Harry Caul in that sense. Like we're fiercely guarding our own privacy, while also, ironically and hypocritically, getting so involved in the lives of others. And I mean, we have reality shows where it's just like all about, you know, people literally watching people on hidden cameras, just going about their daily lives. It's literally called Big Brother, and it's just like, how much more Orwellian can you get? I don't know, there's so many interesting things that you can absolutely pin to today's technologically advanced society, but I think it's definitely for it to come out with all this in 74, you know, it was almost like, was Coppola onto something? Like when did it just kind of like spring to mind while he was like stomping grapes at the winery or something? It's just like, I don't know, but it really is fascinating, and it's got a lot of themes that really makes you think, and I definitely think a lot of people should definitely watch it. Like, if you want like an alternate Coppola film that is very not unlike some of the stuff that he's done. Like, everyone knows him for like the Godfather films, Apocalypse Now, and more recently Megalopolis, which looks and sounds insane, by the way. We'd be very interested to see how that works in an actual cinema, given what we know about some of the stuff that goes on in that film. You heard about this, right? Like apparently, like there was at the screening in Cannes, there was like a moment where like an audience member just comes out and just kind of like starts interacting with Adam
Yeah,
Driver.
audience participation, very theatrical. Very theatrical, yeah.
I have no idea how that's going to work when it's in like the
There
actual
are
proper cinema.
hundreds of actors who are sitting there thinking like, hey, that could be me. I can be in a Coppola
Yes, I can ask Adam Driver a question, kind of.
movie.
But no, I think it's I mean the legacy of this film is definitely felt. I mean, because the film itself was inspired by a film called Blow Up, which was made by Michelangelo Antonioni back in 66, and that in and of itself also inspired Brian De Palma's film Blowout. And both of them have very similar themes of, you know, quite disturbing stuff being caught on camera, on tape, or all that sort of stuff. There was also a film, 98, called Enemy of the State that Gene Hackman also starred in, which a lot of people have theorized that his character in Enemy of the State is actually an older Harry Caul, which is quite interesting because apparently there's a moment in that film where, you know, you see like a younger photo of him and it's just him in the conversation. So that just adds to a lot of people's theories that, oh, maybe this is like a semi-sequel.
Cinematic universe,
The cinematic universe, yeah, and it's
the HCU.
HCU, the Harry Caul universe. I like that. But no, I think just to go back to what we were saying, I think The Conversation is definitely a film that you should see because it's quite a tense film. It's unpredictable. It's got really interesting characters, and it has really strong themes that really play well 50 years later. And I think that it's quite powerful in just how prophetic it is about the nature of surveillance 50 years before its time, before it really kind of has taken off. You know, all the stuff with AI nowadays, it feels like a even further extension of that kind of surveillance. I think that there's so much that this film can really teach a lot of people in just saying like that, just the dangers of not just kind of like becoming obsessed with other people's lives. And in fact, I looked to the German film The Lives of Others from 2006. It's kind of like a recontextualized remake in and of itself, you know, because very different context. Because did you ever see The Lives of Others?
I have, yes.
Yeah, well, so you know, then you know, obviously it's a very similar kind of thing. You know, a guy is like hired to spy on people's lives, and again develops this kind of like parasocial relationship. But it's the way that it plays with like historical significance. I mean, that film takes place in East Germany, and I think it handles a lot of similar themes that The Conversation does. I mean, obviously, it does them very different, but again, it just kind of confirms the legacy that this film has, and just kind of s telling stories about people whose job is to just literally investigate the lives of others, whether it's for nefarious purposes or just because you've been hired to do it or whatever. Yeah, I think it's very powerful in that regard. So that's that. I mean, that's all I have to say about it. I mean, but you obviously know much more about the film than I clearly do. So I mean,
No,
what would you say your
no.
reasons are for people checking out this film?
The simple truth first, you know, when I rewatched this, I made my mom and my sister watch it with me. They
Okay.
happened to be in town, and I thought it'd be fun. And you know, I think they are not they've not seen the film before, that they, you know, they don't have their own biases for it, you know. And I think they both found it interesting. I think, in full disclosure, I think both of them thought it was sort of like a slow burn. And so, you know, if that's going to drive you up the wall, like, I think that it is a slow burn, it because it is a character study in many ways, more than a sort of action thriller. But I think, you know, this idea of what it means to be the people watching a person who is watching, sort of these two removes, us as the audience. You know, we are also always, anytime we watch a film grounded in any of the sort of realist methods of performance or presentation, you know, we too are sort of there to get lost in other people's lives. And I think there's just like an interesting thing that happens there, and getting to watch these artists who made this movie, just who are just at the top of their game. I mean, it's just inarguably they're at the top of their game, and to let yourself sort of fall into that. To let yourself fall into the observation is kind of just a fun experience. And for anyone who's, you know, interested in making work, I think there's just like a, you know, a million takeaways. And again, back to this idea of just the way information is revealed, and way it's not, ways it's where it's not, and how that inspires curiosity and that desire to know more. And I think, like, obviously that's a something you need in all entertainment and media. It's why we keep watching. But I think, like, you know, actually working that curious muscle is a great thing just for everything. I think, like, being curious and allowing yourself to be curious is sort of like what allows you to discover things in life that you might never have discovered otherwise in a positive way. And so I just think the film is awesome. I just think it's awesome. I think it looks good. I think it sounds good. I think the acting is fantastic. I think it's like kind of thrilling and exhilarating and a little nerve-wracking, particularly given the context and given what we know now about how we can be watched and watch others. You know, so those are all the reasons to do it. And of course, it's just, I think it has a historical value. Not that that historical value is a reason enough to watch, but I think combined with everything else I just said, it's like well worth the 2 hours. Like, go and do it. They deserve another $3.99.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a very good way of putting it. So, yeah, no, that I think that's yeah, I think that's it. 50 years on, The Conversation, it more than holds up. So, I think that's a decent enough place to end this sprawling conversation on The Conversation, I guess. So, yeah, no, Max, it's as ever. It's so great having you on this show. It's not great to have someone who's obviously so knowledgeable about all sides of the industry, and just talking about films that we just kind of like love. And obviously, last time you were on, we talked about American Beauty, which is my favorite film. And I think now we're talking on Conversation, which I believe is one of your favorites, if not your actual favorite. So,
Probably not my favorite.
okay.
That would be hard for me to define right this moment, but I just think it's a wonderful film. It's a film I've seen many times, and I will watch again. You know, it's a thing that I can keep going back to.
Yeah, no, honestly, I would like to rewatch this film, and I honestly don't say that a lot about Francis Ford Coppola because, like, I enjoyed the Godfather movies, I enjoyed Apocalypse Now, but I've never like at a point where I'm like, oh, I want to like revisit that anytime soon.
It's funny. I like watch The Godfather now. Like I watched The Godfather very late in life. I missed it. So I didn't watch it until maybe I was like, I don't know, in my late 20s. Like, 'cause it, you know, I was like kind of late to the party. And now I'm like, oh yeah, I'd watch The Godfather right now. You know, but again, it's just the acting is so good, you know, the score, the Nino Rota score, you know, again, thinking about the way sound is used. Whatever you think about Coppola, you know, it is impossible to say that he is not a director with a vision.
Yeah, I think like when you look at everything that's being said right now about Megalopolis, like it's clear that even at his age, he still has the capability to put out just some absolutely bonkers stuff. Like it's just like everything I'm reading about this film, I mean, reviews are mixed, sure, but everything I'm hearing about it just makes me want to see it even more. Like it's just like I've just got to know, you know, like I've just got to know what kind of insane masterpiece he's cooked up. 120 million film, you know, he fi self-financed it, and it's just like
Yeah, it's completely fucking bonkers. I mean, like, it's just completely nuts.
I you know, I've heard it described as like a big budget version of The Room, and I have to say, having heard that, I cannot wait to see this film.
I mean, you know, this is what I think. I just think that he believes in artistry, and like whether you think like it, whether it's good or not, we won't know until we see it. I just think that, you know, he's one of a rare director who's willing to take a big swing and miss. Like, he is not driven by his fear, or by his cowardice. For making films, and I can just say, you know, like working as an independent film producer, there are so many people who are hemmed in by concerns about, you know, is this going to make enough money? Is this going to, and of course you have to engage with those questions. You know, it is media and entertainment. It's, you know, it's art and commerce. It's vision and resources. It's, you know, where do these things meet? So you can't be pie in the sky, like, you know, just fantasize. It doesn't matter. But I think, like, creatively, it's best if you can operate from a place where you're willing to take the risks, willing to take creative chances, and then you have to try and figure out how to fit those creative chances into a format that makes sense to the people who are financing the films. For Coppola, lucky him. I don't have wineries to sell off to make my movies. So, you know, he only had to convince himself, which he did. You know, he didn't have to convince anyone else. And that's a great luxury that he's got. But you know what? The more power to him, I think. The fact that he doesn't have to convince anyone else, and I almost think he has a responsibility and a right as an artist and as a filmmaker to try and make whatever his crazy movie he wants. And, you know, we'll get to sit and judge it. And, you know, I think we'll all be better off for having that opportunity.
I completely agree. So yeah, that's Megalopolis is definitely one to watch. So Max, that brings about an end to this conversation about the
Thanks.
conversation. I know we mentioned this last time you're on the show, but where can people find you on social media?
Oh, of course. You can, you know, you can always check out Noble Gas Media. You know, is my production company. You can find Noble Gas Media at noblegasmedia.com, and you can find out more about what we do and the projects we're working on and the projects that we have worked on previously. And then me personally, you can find me on Instagram at Wortendyke. That's my last name, Wortendyke. Or you can just, you know, shoot me an email at max@noblegasmedia.com.
Awesome. And I'll link to all of those in the episode description. So, yeah, and I think that's about it. Thank you very much for listening or watching, whichever platform you may be listening on. And look forward to talking more film stuff next time. So, for now, thanks for watching or listening. And Max, it's great to see you.
You too, Jack. Thanks so much for having me, as always.
That's all. N until next time.
Till next time, bye.
Hey, you've made it to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for sticking around. Please like and subscribe on whichever platform you may be listening on. Make sure that you're following Film Feeder on all our social media channels, the links and handles to which are all listed in the episode description. And do consider supporting Film Feeder either on our Patreon or Ko-fi pages, the links to which are also in the description, where even the smallest donation, either monthly or as a one-off, will be an enormous contribution towards helping a hard-working creative like myself. Finally, don't forget to visit the FilmFeeder website at filmfeeder.co.uk, where I post regular written reviews and weekly movie menus that round up all the latest movies coming to cinemas, streaming, and on demand here in the UK. Until next time, I'm Jack Martin, your film chef extraordinaire, whetting your appetite for film each and every month. Bye for now!